curse.
The journey of Spider-Man through multiple reboots and introduction to the MCU and now unceremoniously being removed from the MCU really tells the story for me of how the MCU came to be and why it works the way Marvel and Disney have done it, and also why other superhero movies have not worked or not worked as well. I think it's just a super fascinating story, especially the way you lay it out really clearly, because it goes in so many different directions and it relates to so many different things. So that's why I wanted you to just lay it out, especially now it was, I guess, announced essentially that the Tom Holland Spider-Man will no longer be incorporated into the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Yeah, not even so much announced as the story was broken, I believe, by Deadline. And then once that started circulating everywhere, Sony recognized the need to publicly respond and issued a response to Deadline that was then picked up by The Hollywood Reporter. And Sony actually tweeted, which makes it about as public as a statement can be.
Well, which is interesting because this is the second time that public sentiment has forced Sony into a formal business decision that might not have been finalized, right?
Yeah, and there's speculation, you know, even as we're taping this, that some of this public back and forth is kind of an intentional bargaining chip, because we do have, you know, immovable object versus irresistible force right now, where, you know, Marvel seems to be saying it has to be this way or no way. And Sony seems to be saying, well, we won't go that way, but we'll do something better for you than what we've been doing. And, you know, who knows where that's going to land. But yeah, there's a lot of interesting factors.
Let's start with the beginning of this particular storyline, the story arc of Sony and Spider-Man, because I think a lot of people, even people like me who are fans, I guess, you know, lowercase f fans of yeah. comics and comic culture, we might know a little bit about this, but at a glance, you know, why does Marvel not control the cinematic rights to some of their biggest characters, and how did that get us from the Sam Raimi Spider-Man movies to now?
You know, obviously these are characters that have been around since the 60s, and in Captain America's case, even longer. Spider-Man is arguably the most recognizable Marvel superhero, or certainly was prior to this current golden age of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. In the years before Blade, or in the Fox X-Men films, and the Sam Raimi Spider-Man trilogy, which really gave us glimmers of hope and in some cases really good movies about Marvel superheroes, you know, there hadn't really been much comic book-wise, with the exception of the Chris Raitt movies and two bad sequels, and of course the Tim Burton Batman. But, you know, Marvel really, you know, great animation, different things we could talk about there that would waste too much time and take us off course. But, you know, they had a lot, they had animated stuff going. They had the live action Spider-Man TV series at one point, which, you know, there were various things, but there wasn't a real, like, kick-ass Marvel movie. And this was an era, you know, even going into the 70s, 80s, and early 90s, when Hollywood still didn't think comic book movies would work, you know, and or if they were going to do a comic book movie, you know, it either had to be super campy, like a Dick Tracy or something, or The Mask, or you had to strip away a bunch of its goofier, you know, the perceived sort of cheesiness, corniness of superheroes aesthetically and all of that to make it palatable to a major audience. So it's even something like Organic Web Shooters, which, you know, the Sam Raimi Spider-Man movies I like, and I know Sam Raimi was a legitimate fan of the 60s comics, but even that was like a little example of like, well, here's something we could do better in a movie.
Yeah.
that really wasn't better and didn't really need to happen. So one of the first Marvel films was the Dolph Lundgren Punisher, which we talked about a little bit on Hoosier Illusion in a recent episode that was about Dolph Lundgren and mental health. That's a real thing. You should download that episode and listen to it. But the Dolph Lundgren Punisher takes away the Punisher skull. And it's like, if there's one thing, you know, there's the definition, right, of like, you had one job. Like, the one job of a Punisher movie is to put that cool fucking skull that everyone loves, that's so iconic, on the guy's shirt, or at least on the poster or somewhere. It was nowhere. And you can just feel that that was a decision that someone made that was like, well, we can't have that. That's cheesy. but we can have Louis Gossett Jr. getting in fistfights with the Yakuza ninjas. That isn't cheesy. We had the 1990s Captain America movie. Ugh, the less said about that, the better. The Roger Corman Fantastic Four movie, which, as legend has it, was made simply to retain the rights. So this is where it gets into your question about rights and how everything ended up so messy. And what's part of what's so disappointing about this Spider-Man news is that it's coming at a time when the vast majority of these complicated deals have finally been untangled, and we're able to have this MCU that seems so much closer, you know, certainly closer than ever before, to being able to incorporate the whole of the Marvel Universe from the comics. And now all of a sudden we have this obstacle thrown back in our path. What happened was Marvel struggled financially at different points, went through different corporate ownerships, had all sorts of problems over, you know, peaks and valleys, as big companies will, throughout the course of its history. Once upon a time, you know, it had these assets of, you know, intellectual property of these great characters, and they started licensing them out and selling them off one by one in attempts to get live action things made. So we had the Incredible Hulk TV show. At one point after that series ended, you know, with the great Bill Bixby and Lou Ferrigno, they tried a couple of TV movies that were these standalone Hulk films and TV films intended to introduce other Marvel characters for potential spinoffs. There was one that had Thor. There was one with Daredevil. Of course, Thor didn't look like he did in the comics. Daredevil didn't look like he did in the comics. you know, but they tried those. You know, there was a Doctor Strange TV movie, I think, at some point. There were these little blips and everything, but there were a lot of attempts to get things made and a lot of deals that were by no means looking at this idea of a cinematic universe, which wasn't something that was on anyone's radar.
It wasn't a thing. You know,
yeah, it just wasn't a thing. You ended up with all of these marquee characters kind of languishing in all of these different places. Fantastic Four, Daredevil, and the X-Men ended up with Fox. The Hulk ended up with Universal. Spider-Man ended up with Sony. And, you know, the list goes on. I believe Ghost Rider was at Universal. The Punisher was with Lionsgate. All these different deals were made in attempts to bring all these characters to the screen in various fashions and to varying degrees of success, commercially and critically. The result was, yeah, a lot of different licensing deals with a lot of different studios. And also keep in mind, at this time, Marvel Studios wasn't a thing. You know, Marvel Entertainment or whatever, Marvel Films, Avi Arad and some of these other movie producer people would be associated with all of these different Marvel properties, but they were still very distinct and very separate from one another as stories and as characters and so on. At Fox, where they had the X-Men, Daredevil, and Fantastic Four, there wasn't any thought of crossing them over. In fact, they were against it for whatever reason, which is a whole other thing to unpack. And again, part of what's so great about what the MCU has done is how they've been able to succeed in combining all these different franchises. So when I say different characters were sold off, part of what comes with that are the supporting cast members. When a studio gets the rights to Daredevil, that also means Elektra goes there, Bullseye goes there, Foggy Nelson, Karen Page, you know, all of the...
That's something that casual fans might not realize, is that there's the universe, but there's little constellations of related characters. Like,
yes,
the X-Men is a collection of intellectual property. Fantastic Four is a collection, and you can't really, I mean, it's been proven, like, you can't separate these characters from their context and really do much of value with them.
Yeah, and where there were definitely some instances where this created complications. For example, Ben Urich, who is a newspaper reporter for the Daily Bugle in the Marvel Universe, the Daily Bugle being where Spider-Man is sometimes employed as a photographer, Ben is also a character more associated with the Daredevil stable. So when that character of the reporter, played by Joe Pantoliano in the Daredevil film, showed up in this Fox movie, he worked for a different newspaper because the Daily Bugle belongs with Spider-Man over at Sony. And Fox couldn't use the Daily Bugle. So even though they had this character from the Daily Bugle in the comics, and that character was theirs, he couldn't work there. A similar thing occurred several years later, where Quicksilver, who is the, you know, brother of Scarlet Witch, and they're both the children of Magneto in the comics, Quicksilver somehow ended up, and also both of those characters have been in the Avengers, he somehow ended up with both the Fox stable of characters and the Avengers stable of characters, which is how we ended up with two different actors playing two different Quicksilvers.
Yeah, in two different franchises.
Yeah, X-Men Age of Ultron Avengers Age of Ultron and X-Men Days of Future Past, two different Quicksilvers. And this is how that happens. Situation very similar to this Spider-Man situation where Universal had the rights to the Hulk. A deal was made between the then new Marvel Studios and Universal to kind of work together on this standalone Hulk kind of soft reboot sequel-ish to the Ang Lee Hulk movie. Part of that deal was Universal saying Marvel could use the Hulk in their team-up movies. So that's why we've had Mark Ruffalo in multiple Avengers movies, but we haven't had another standalone Hulk movie. And what's interesting is, you know, when Marvel decided they wanted to do Planet Hulk, where the Hulk leaves Earth because everyone hates him and, you know, ends up on this alien planet where he becomes a champion gladiator, they just took that and put it in a Thor movie, which also helped revitalize and shake up the Thor franchise, and everyone wins, and Marvel presumably gets to say, it's a Hulk movie, it's a team-up movie, it's, you said we could use them in teams.
Yeah. You know, look at the poster, it says Thor.
Exactly. So one of many masterful moves on the part of Marvel Studios. To my knowledge, the first real attempt at making a Spider-Man movie goes way back to the Cannon Group, the low-rent production house responsible for the Dolph Lundgren Masters of the Universe movie, American Ninja, and the rightfully horribly received Superman 4, a movie so bad that Christopher Reeve abandoned the character. That company, the Cannon Group, had the rights to Spider-Man reportedly for less than $250,000. They nabbed Spider-Man rights from, and to put that in perspective, Spider-Man Far From Home is now the biggest film in Sony Pictures history. it has outgrossed Skyfall, which was previously their biggest movie. So, so for less than $250,000, the Cannon Group had the rights, and they were eyeing Tom Cruise as their Peter Parker. Now, this is no dig at Cruise's acting chops, but we're talking about the 1980s, which was before, of course, the critical and box office badassery of the MCU. And there's, you know, plenty of cinema quality stories in those comic books, but everything at that time was still getting stalled in some type of development hell. So, and then, yeah, when movies did make it across the finish line, they tended to be disasters like Captain America and the Punisher film. At some point after that, as Charlie Sheen revealed a few years ago on Jay Moore's podcast, he once campaigned pretty heavily to play Spider-Man. This was when he was a big deal at Orion Pictures, who had just put out his Oscar-winning film Platoon. Sheen says he had an office there and pitched them Spider-Man, but they weren't interested. Quote, they said, comic books are not the future, and I said, but it's Spider-Man. I'm perfect.
He didn't. That's a bizarre assessment.
Yeah. He didn't have the rights, but he was looking to buy them. And then Orion Pictures ended up filing for bankruptcy in 1991. So much for that. Then the next possible attempt could have had Edward Furlong, who recently is returning to the Terminator franchise.
He actually falls somewhere outside of the spectrum of what they've had. Like, he wouldn't have been that crazy compared to...
Well, and even, I mean, Charlie Sheen seems crazy at any point, but, or Tom Cruise even, but I think a lot of that is our sort of hindsight. You know, if you think about post-Platoon Charlie Sheen, like, I don't know, that might have worked.
I don't think Maverick would have worked under any circumstances.
No, he's just because part of what works about Spider-Man and Marvel characters in general is that he's flawed. And,
yeah,
you know, and Tom Cruise...
Well, he's an awkward kid.
Tom Cruise would have made a better Iron Man, a better Tony Stark, which almost happened. Not, certainly not better than Robert Downey Jr., but I mean better than Peter Parker. Okay, so Eddie Furlong, the production company responsible for Rambo, Showgirls, and Terminator 2 Judgment Day, they were all ready to take a crack at Spider-Man in the early 90s with James Cameron both writing and directing. Cameron, of course, coming off of, you know, Terminator and Aliens and, you know, his great track record that was cruising along. He would have reunited his Terminator 2 star Edward Furlong with Arnold Schwarzenegger, with Eddie Furlong as Peter Parker and Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Would we have gotten another Guns N' Roses track on the soundtrack?
Oh man, can you imagine their take on a Spider-Man song? Yeah, Arnold is Doc Ock, but then Carolco, which is that company, another weird company like the Cannon Group, although albeit, you know, much more successful, they went bankrupt before their Spider-Man could get made. James Cameron, of course, moved on to make Titanic. And Eddie Furlong's comic book movie career picked back up with 2005's The Crow, Wicked Prayer, co-starring Tara Reid.
Yeah, wicked awful.
Yeah, I once interviewed Edward Furlong, who was pretty inebriated and had his arm in a cast at the premiere for the Jonas Åkerlund film Spun, where I asked him about the Crow movie that he was making at the time, and he said, "Yeah, I'm the Crow. And, like, I come back as the Crow, and I put on the makeup, and I, like, kill the bad guys." It was horrific, that conversation. At the same premiere, I interviewed future MCU villain Mickey Rourke, and I asked him a pretty standard journalist question: what drew you to the script? And Mickey Rourke leaned into me and said, "You know, I'll be honest with you. The script was shit. I thought it was terrible. But, you know, I'm trying to listen to my agents more these days. My agent said, you know, this guy's done a lot of big music videos. So just do it anyway. Here I am."
That's rare honesty.
Yeah, and by the way, I don't know if Mickey Rourke knows what movie he's in Iron Man 2. I do still appreciate his performance and all the weird shit with the bird. And he was fun. That was
the board.
And we'll, and you know what? We'll get there. We're going to do an Iron Man 2 episode. So
bring me the board.
The board.
I love that character and that performance. I love Mickey Rourke.
I love Mickey Rourke too. I love Mickey. Fun fact: in the Expendables movie that Mickey Rourke is in, he has this long monologue, and it turns out that he had the monologue written out and taped to the mirror in front of him, and he is literally reading the monologue off the wall. And the monologue Sly Stallone described as the soul of that movie. It's like somewhere in the middle, and it, you know, really gets to the heart of
the Expendables.
Yeah. I enjoyed the first two, and then the third, I think they got it in their head that, like, oh, these are successful. Let's try to make, like, a real movie this time. And they forgot that it's fun satire. And three suffered as a result. So this is where we get into Sony. So after, you know, the Cannon Group and Carolco and those attempts, and Charlie Sheen wanting Orion Pictures to buy the Spider-Man rights. The Spider-Man rights were next purchased by Sony. And the thing that you were referencing earlier that I know you wanted me to mention, because it's hilarious, is that Marvel reportedly offered to throw in the rest of their entire stable of characters, along with Spider-Man and his supporting cast and associated rogues gallery, for like just a few million more. And Sony said, "Nah, we're good. We just want Spider-Man." Which, of course, in 2019 is fucking hilarious. But at the time, yeah, you know, probably seemed to make good business sense. So once it was at Sony, they liked the script that James Cameron had been working on at Carolco before Carolco went bankrupt. But now, you know, Titanic was a thing. And so then instead of Edward Furlong, it was like, let's have that Leonardo DiCaprio fellow play Peter Parker. However, DiCaprio, who had been offered the role of Robin in Batman Forever that went to Chris O'Donnell, and at some point was in the running or talked about a lot or offered Anakin Skywalker in the Star Wars prequels, he turned all of those characters down. He just wasn't, you know, he didn't see himself suiting up in a big franchise as a superhero or a Jedi, and, you know, went on to have the Leonardo DiCaprio career that he has had instead. DiCaprio doesn't want to do it, and then there was the supposedly the Kingpin issue with Cameron, so that fell apart. Sony next shined their spotlight onto an actor from the movie The Talented Mr. Ripley named Jude Law, who, you know, may not remember this now, but he actually earned an Oscar nomination for Best Supporting Actor for that movie. You know, Columbia, Sony Pictures made some overtures to him about Spider-Man. He was also offered, at one point, the lead in Superman Returns. Reportedly turned that down because he didn't like how the costume looked on him. And that's a whole... That's a whole other episode, the attempt to get Superman back on the big screen after Superman 4, and everything that happened in between that and Superman Returns, and then everything between Superman Returns and Man of Steel.
We're going to need to make a multiverse poster of all the different possible people who
who could have
put the capes on.
So when I was researching this a while back, I dug up a report from Entertainment Weekly that was published in June 2000. Which mentioned talking about Sony's attempt to make a Spider-Man movie, and it mentioned Leonardo DiCaprio, Jude Law, and Freddie Prinze Jr. as potential Spider-Man hopefuls, which by that point, Sam Raimi was now attached to direct it. Several years after the fact, Prinze told Howard Stern that he was the studio's first choice, but that Raimi lobbied Sony for Maguire instead. So Sony wanted Freddie Prinze Jr., Raimi wanted Maguire, Raimi won. And, you know, as much as Freddie Prinze Jr. was once showing up in everything and then seemingly shows up in nothing, he was the voice of Kanan Jarrus, the last Padawan, one of the primary heroes on Star Wars Rebels, a very cool character. And he did a very great job. And he's married to Sarah Michelle Gellar, and who can be mad at that?
That's a 90s power couple.
This is getting us very, very close to very, very modern history, which is... James Franco was the next name, you know. So now we've got Raimi.
Dear God.
We've got Raimi. We've got Sony. We've got this thing moving forward. James Franco, of course, co-starred in all three of Raimi's Spider-Man films as Peter Parker's best friend, but he initially auditioned to play the lead before he was ultimately cast as Harry Osborn, the son of the Green Goblin. It's not dissimilar from Cillian Murphy in the Dark Knight trilogy, who auditioned to play Batman and was cast as the Scarecrow. Another '90s star, Scott Speedman of J.J. Abrams' teen soap Felicity. One third of the love triangle driving that show. He was a teen heartthrob like Freddie Prinze Jr., who got close to the Peter Parker role. He screen tested for Sam Raimi, and as listeners may or may not remember, made his way into the Underworld franchise at some point not long after that. Last but not least, another potential Spider-Man once they started making the Raimi trilogy. So the first Spider-Man movie comes out. It's a big success. In the run-up to Spider-Man 2, which a lot of people to this day consider the best comic book film ever. People love Spider-Man 2. Did he or didn't he throw out his back, Tobey Maguire? Did he throw out his back in the run-up to Spider-Man 2, or was it a negotiating tactic to get more money for the sequel, as was rumored at the time? Either way, when Toby acted like he wasn't going to show up for Spider-Man 2, Sony wasn't screwing around. They had Jake Gyllenhaal waiting in the wings. Huh. Maguire, of course, did show up for what became one of the best superhero movies ever. There's a joke in Spider-Man 2, like in the movie, about Peter Parker's back. There's some kind of, I forget the exact reference, and hopefully there's a nerd listening to this that will remind me, but there's a scene where he says something like, "Oh, my back," and it's totally a nod to this, you know, Hollywood trades drama that was happening. And there's also a sort of reference, a meta reference to this on HBO's Entourage. If you're familiar or not familiar with that show, the show's fictional A-lister, Vincent Chase, starred in an Aquaman movie directed in the show by James Cameron. Vinny Chase got into a negotiating battle with the studio in the show and was replaced in Aquaman 2 by Jake Gyllenhaal. So that was all a bunch of meta, like, you know, commentary on all this shit we're talking about. So here's what happens with a lot of these deals. If the rights holders with the licensing deals don't make films within a certain amount of time, if they're not cranking out some kind of Fantastic Four, X-Men, Spider-Man, whatever the property is, related feature film every certain number of years, the rights will revert back to Marvel. That's how those deals are all structured. So what happened in the case of Daredevil, for example, you know, Daredevil was kind of this outlier because it came out post-Blade, post-X-Men, but pre, you know, it's just that weird moment. And it's thought of as a flop because it was sort of, you know, it was during the whole Bennifer era of Ben Affleck and Jennifer Lopez, and they were in the tabloids and people started looking at him very differently, and it wasn't really a critical success. But people forget it opened, I think, Valentine's Day weekend in 2002 or three, and it did well. It had like a $40 million opening or something, which was pretty big for that time. Incidentally, I covered the press junket for that movie, interviewed the whole cast and the director, and I remember interviewing Michael Clark Duncan, rest in peace, who played the Kingpin in the Ben Affleck Daredevil film, and he and I talking about how much he wanted to battle Spider-Man. And that he really wanted to, having done this Daredevil movie, play the Kingpin again in a Spider-Man movie. So hats off to Michael Clark Duncan for a number of reasons, but here specifically for having the foresight 17 years ago to be thinking about these epic crossovers that are now commonplace and so massively successful. There was also, as people may or may not remember, a Daredevil spinoff at Fox called Elektra, featuring Jennifer Garner as her character from the Daredevil film. And as legend has it, there's a dream sequence or something. There was some kind of cameo from Affleck as Daredevil that was filmed for Elektra and never used. And it didn't show up in the theatrical or even on the DVD. And if memory serves me correctly, that was another example of a studio going like, I don't know, that might confuse people. You know, this movie isn't Daredevil, it's Elektra. It's like, people are going to be like, what's Ben Affleck? What's this Daredevil guy? Why is this in here? It's just so funny how different it is from, you know, the era we live in now where studios are scrambling to make, like, you know, a Ghostbusters shared universe. The movie came and went. Affleck rather famously was dissatisfied with the end result, and it was his favorite superhero at the time. It was Matt Damon's favorite superhero. Kevin Smith, their pal, had written a bunch of Daredevil comics. He has a cameo in that movie. They were all pretty disappointed. Ben Affleck and Jennifer Garner would very much later end up getting together and starting a family together, having three kids, and were married for a long time. But that movie, yeah, it I would say, and we'll probably get into it when we reach Daredevil in our MCU rewatch, the Netflix MCU adjacent series. But Daredevil, that film, for anyone listening who never saw it or saw it and didn't like it, I would recommend giving the director's cut a watch, because the director's cut restores like something like 20 minutes, which in movie time is a lot.
Yeah.
It puts a whole entire subplot involving the Kingpin and a criminal played by Coolio back into the film. And but it also just has like a lot of great moments that were chopped, like, you know, slow motion hallway walk of Battling Jack Murdock and his devilish red ringside robe walking to the boxing ring and young Matt Murdock trailing behind and stuff like that, where in the director commentary, Mark Steven Johnson, the writer director, is complaining, like, just very honestly about being told, yep, I was told cut this, get to the action, get to the next fight, get to the next explosion. And there were all these story beats and character moments, not to say that suddenly that Daredevil movie becomes The Godfather, but it certainly is a much better film. I would even say, and this is a whole separate conversation, as much of a slog as it is to get through Batman v Superman in any form, believe it or not, the longer version that came out as the director's version or whatever is, again, a better film, because it puts a bunch of stuff back in there that really needed to be in there. You know, there's a lot of movies like the Star Wars prequels where you watch deleted scenes and you're like, I understand why that came out.
Yeah.
But, you know, Daredevil and even Batman v Superman are examples of movies that it was a real disservice that they were, and probably the Justice League movie, that they had this mandate to be a certain length and lose certain things. For whatever reason, Fox wasn't able to make the deadline, and it went right up to the 11th hour of rebooting Daredevil before the rights reverted back to Marvel. So that's how that ended up back at Marvel. And I believe The Punisher was kind of a similar thing. Ghost Rider, you know, there were those couple of movies. Also, the first Ghost Rider movie written and directed by Mark Steven Johnson, the same guy that did Daredevil. You know, those characters all sort of slowly and quietly made their way back to Marvel and kind of the post-MCU and then Disney era. Spider-Man, on the other hand, much like the X-Men and Fantastic Four, stayed pretty damn firmly where they had been. So this gets us right up to now. The Spider-Man trilogy, Sam Raimi, the third movie comes around, and that's where studio meddling and movie by committee and corporate interference really started to muddy the waters, because Sam Raimi is this like 60s Spider-Man, Stan Lee, Steve Ditko loving fanboy of a certain Marvel era who loves all these classic Spidey villains like Dr. Octopus and the Green Goblin and the Lizard and so on. He wanted to make a film with the Sandman as the primary villain. Sony wanted a film with Venom, because Venom is very popular with Generation X kids and people that were into more recent eras of Marvel Comics. So you end up with this big artistic compromise where we have too many villains, and it's become sort of the, you know, that and the Batman and Robin movie from Joel Schumacher. You know, those are kind of the gold standard for superhero movies with too many villains and too much happening. And we got Spider-Man 3, where we did alien symbiote costume, dark Peter Parker. We did Eddie Brock Venom. We did the Sandman and the Sandman's ailing daughter. And we did, we revisited the killing of Uncle Ben. Turns out the Sandman was involved. And we did the second Goblin Jr. of Harry Osborn taking over from Norman Osborn, but also some sort of amalgam of the Green Goblin, the second Green Goblin from the comics, and the Hobgoblin that was just this like weird Franco Goblin in like this black suit. We had all of, I don't know if you remember, but we had all of that in Spider-Man 3. Which,
it was a lot.
Yeah, it had a huge opening. It was massively successful, driven, of course, by the momentum of the beloved first two films, but it was a critical failure. So Sony was moving forward with a Spider-Man 4 to be written and directed by Sam Raimi. Now, as legend has it, he wanted the Vulture as the villain, with John Malkovich as the rumored actor to play that role. And if you remember, the Vulture from the comics and any sort of cartoon iteration and things that we had seen prior to, you know, like Marvel Ultimates maybe, or the Michael Keaton version, which I think was awesome. The Vulture was like an elderly, bald, old man, you know? And perhaps understandably, Sony was like, you know, we just don't think, you know, for these like kid-friendly, big budget, huge production, superhero blockbusters, we don't think that an old man in a bird suit is going to be the best choice of villain. Again, this was the same, you know, movie by committee where they had shoved Venom into that movie against Sam Raimi's wishes. This also happened to coincide with the release of Avatar, when suddenly all of Hollywood got super horny for 3D and not only started making movies in 3D, but started retro converting already shot films like the Clash of the Titans remake into 3D, which was like the worst. Like those movies that did that were like painful to watch. And so
I think 3D is painful to watch, period.
Conversation for another time, but I mostly agree. So unless it's Friday the 13th 3D, because that was fun.
Yes.
So, because, you know, Jason's throwing a harpoon at your face. What's not to love?
Yeah.
But Sony comes in with this mandate of, like, Spider-Man 4's got to be in 3D, and we're not so hot on the Vulture as your villain. And so that battle's already happening. They had the drama with Tobey Maguire prior to Spider-Man 2. Also, and perhaps most importantly, to my understanding, Sony's deal with Sam Raimi, Tobey Maguire, and Kirsten Dunst was for three films. So now you've had these three massively successful pictures and all of those people out of their deal. Everyone wants to make Spider-Man 4, the creative team, the cast, and the studio, but it's going to be even more expensive than ever before, because now all of those people are in a position to negotiate new paydays for themselves and, you know, bigger shares of participation in the Spider-Man 4 money. So with the ticking clock of, we need to make a Spider-Man movie or the rights go back to Marvel. And around this time, Marvel Studios now becoming a thing, Sony makes the business decision of, you know, look, we're going to have to spend a shitload of money on Tobey Maguire, Kirsten Dunst, and Sam Raimi. We're trying to force him to do 3D, which he doesn't want to do. That's going to be a fight. He wants a villain that we don't want. That'll be a fight. We had a big villain compromise on the last movie, and it didn't turn out well with critics and fans. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to let all those people go and hire like an indie film director and an unknown and start over. So on paper, you can understand that move. You know, to look at it from just a purely business standpoint.
Yeah, it makes total sense.
It was cheaper. It was easier. They got Mark Webb, who had done 500 Days of Summer and a little hardcore connection, had directed early videos for AFI and Hatebreed, and which I wish I knew when I interviewed him.
His perseverance took him far in the film industry.
Yeah, his perseverance. He was, I mean, it was like Days of the Phoenix, the way he rose, sailed on his black sails into the sunset. Yeah, and so that's how we get the Andrew Garfield Spider-Man. So without following all of this, which it's totally understandable why most people wouldn't, even actual big fans, it's absolutely understandable that people would look at this and go, how and why the fuck are we getting a Spider-Man reboot when we just had Spider-Man 3 like 5 seconds ago? Yeah. Like, why are they starting over? And worse, and I think this was the biggest creative mistake that they made, the reboot was like from the beginning. Like,
yeah,
bit by a radioactive spider.
Why didn't they just do Spider-Man 4 with different people? Like, that's not unprecedented.
It's not. Yeah, that's a great question. I wonder, you know, I've never seen anything about that. I've never seen anyone ask that. I wonder why that wasn't, I'm sure it had to have been considered. I wonder why that wasn't the direction they went. I mean, maybe they're afraid it's going to be, you know, the Dukes of Hazzard season with the other cousins.
Yeah, you just insert a joke about how it's a different
well, now,
actor, and then you move on.
You could do that now, yeah. Like the Roseanne, the Beckys on Roseanne.
Yeah.
But yeah, so they went that route, and, you know, The Amazing Spider-Man was actually fairly well-received, all things considered. I personally didn't see it because I just didn't need to see Uncle Ben die again. I didn't need to see the spider bite him. I didn't need to see him make his costume. I didn't need to see him learn how to swing on webs or go, whoa, what are these crazy powers? I just didn't need to do all of that again so soon. And it's kind of like, you know, this meme of like the Waynes must die. Like people keep making Batman movies where they keep making us watch Bruce and Martha Wayne die. We even had to watch it in a Superman movie most recently. And it's like, you know,
how many times must they die?
Yeah, I mean, we know Superman and Batman and Spider-Man's origins. If your butt is in the seat for one of those films, you know the gist. Like, you know these characters at least well enough to know Last Son of Krypton, Gotham City Vigilante, he's an orphan billionaire. Like, these kind of basics you know, and to spend even 10 minutes, let alone, you know, and especially after Batman Begins gave us, like, okay, that's an origin story, you know? Like,
yeah,
to keep doing these again and again. So we did this all over again with Spider-Man. So as the MCU is becoming a thing, Sony goes, so we've rebooted Spider-Man with, you know, pretty successfully. People were all right with Andrew Garfield's Spider-Man movie. We have all these other Spider-Man characters. We could create our own little mini Marvel universe of Spider-Man characters. So here's what we'll do. We're going to make The Amazing Spider-Man a trilogy, and we're going to use this as a launch pad to make a Sinister Six movie, to make Mobius the Living Vampire, to make Venom, to make Silver Sable, to make Black Cat, to make all of these peripheral Spider-Man supporting players into franchises and do crossovers and team ups, and we'll just have our own mini Marvel Cinematic Universe over here at Sony. Again, on paper, not necessarily a bad plan. The problem is that then they made The Amazing Spider-Man 2, and I would argue, much like Batman v Superman, tried to rush their way into the Avengers way too fast, set up too many storylines, put too many villains in it. They decided a great reimagining of Electro would be having Jamie Foxx painted blue. A reimagining of the Rhino would be putting Paul Giamatti in like a Transformers outfit. Just a lot of bad decisions. And then that movie came and flopped. So you have the MCU powerhouse chugging along with everyone but the X-Men, Fantastic Four, and Spider-Man. And you have Sony separately now staring down the barrel of potentially rebooting Spider-Man a third time in a very short number of years. cast your minds back to the controversy when James Franco, former Spider-Man trilogy co-star, and Seth Rogen made a movie, a comedy, about the part of the plot involved killing North Korea's leader. North Korea, in retaliation, hacked Sony, the studio responsible for that film. All these Sony emails came spilling out into the internet, and in those emails, of the many revelations, the general public, the movie-going audience, learned that there had been a conversation happening between Amy Pascal, the head of Sony, and a producer on all those Spider-Man films of yore, and Kevin Feige, the head of Marvel Studios, about figuring out some sort of universal Hulk-type way of incorporating Spider-Man into the Marvel Universe. Due to that leak, as I remember it, it sort of like once that idea was out there, it was kind of like, well, they have to do that.
Yeah.
You know, once people knew that that could be a thing. You know, the Marvel folks love Spider-Man, of course, and wanted him back very desperately. And Sony recognized that they had screwed the pooch, to quote Tony Stark in Spider-Man Homecoming. So a deal was struck that said, you know, similar to the Hulk, we're going to do the Spider-Man movies, but we'll bring you in to co-produce and have some creative control and kind of show us where we've gone wrong. In exchange, you guys can have Spider-Man for your team-up movies. So Tom Holland was introduced as the new Spider-Man in Civil War. We skipped his fucking origin. We never even saw Uncle Ben. You know, there's a scene in Homecoming where Ned asks him about the spider, and he says, "The spider's dead, Ned." You know, and it's that's fucking fantastic. And Tom Holland, by everyone's estimation, is like a perfect Peter Parker. It's just, you know, it worked. It was fucking excellent. And somehow this character that we thought we were tired of right now and wanted to have put away for a while.
Yeah, we wanted the spider to be dead.
Yeah, exactly. We're all super excited about Spider-Man again, and we can't wait to see Spider-Man in his own movie now that we've seen him in Civil War. Here's where Hollywood fucks up, as Hollywood likes to do. Spider-Man in Civil War is awesome. Spider-Man Homecoming is awesome. It's kind of important as it relates to this current conversation and the news over the last couple of days to point out that Spider-Man Homecoming is very much enveloped within the MCU. It's not, I mean, you know, the Marvel Netflix shows, for example, which theoretically take place in the MCU, we're talking a couple of mentions of the Avengers characters, sometimes not even by name, and some like newspaper headlines referencing the Battle of New York and the.
My guess is that for the average movie-going public, there was no realization that they were produced by different studios. Like it just felt like
exactly
a seamless extension.
I mean, I remember I want to say Iron Man was even on the poster. He was certainly all over the trailers, and you know, you get Tony Stark was a big part of the movie. Happy Hogan's in the movie. You have numerous references to the Avengers. You know, there's the great scene where Spider-Man's fighting the ATM robbers, and he's like, "Oh, Hulk, Thor, I haven't met you guys yet." And I mean, it really goes all in. And you know, you get those great little Captain America moments in the high school.
Yeah,
it's there. And then I would say even more so, of course, Tom Holland Spider-Man was a big part of Infinity War. And everyone was very happy to see him back in Endgame, and that was a big emotional moment. And that was a big part of Tony Stark's arc and his motivation for going through with the time heist was his guilt over, you know, mentoring and being this father figure for Peter Parker and then losing him on Titan. So that was a big part of the emotional journey of Avengers 3 and 4. And then I would say even more so than Homecoming, Far From Home is not just a Spider-Man movie, it's like an Endgame epilogue. You know, it closes out that phase of the Marvel movies story-wise, and it deals with the aftermath of the death of Tony Stark and what that means for Spider-Man and what, you know, what that means for Happy Hogan. You know, we get Sam Jackson, we get, you know, and spoiler, I'm sure if you're listening to this, you've seen it by now. We learn in the post-credits scene that the Maria Hill and Nick Fury we've been with for the entire film are actually Skrulls, and that the real Nick Fury and Maria Hill are off in space doing who knows what that we'll find out about in some future MCU film. That's all baked into this Spider-Man Far From Home movie, which is a Sony movie, which makes the news of the last couple of days just really kind of insane. I should throw in here that there was the Venom film with Tom Hardy, which is not an MCU movie, and unlike every MCU film, was not, you know, everything that Marvel Studios has touched has been a huge blockbuster and largely critically acclaimed and beloved. And we even got the first Best Picture nom for a superhero movie with Black Panther. I mean, it's unprecedented. It's crazy the ground that they've broken with all these different franchises and the way all these other studios have tried to create their own little cinematic universes and have all varying degrees failed. Of success, we'll say. Yeah. I don't want to say failed because I don't want to get torched by DC fanboys, but varying degrees of success, we can say safely. Venom, you know, it's almost sort of this black mark because it's dogpiled critically. I think everybody at least appreciates the strangeness of Tom Hardy's performance. I actually enjoyed the movie because I enjoyed Tom Hardy in it.
Yeah, I think we agreed that it's fun trash.
It's fun trash. Critic buddy of mine, Drew McWeeny, I think was the one who said it feels like a 90s superhero movie. And he was like, and then I remember him tweeting like, oh, I just heard that Eminem is doing the theme song. Like, how much more 90s could this movie be? It is what it is. But as I understand it, not unlike Daredevil or Batman v Superman, there's some longer version of Venom that's hypothetically much better. You know, Tom Hardy did some interviews early on in the process. And also much like Jared Leto as the Joker in Suicide Squad, you know, these were guys who showed up for the final cut of their film and were like, where's all the good shit I did? There's an argument that there could be some much better version of it, and that Tom Rothman, the current head of Sony and former head of Fox, oversaw pulling together the version of Venom that made it into theaters. To his credit, it was a huge success. Commercially, that Venom movie did super well, and they are moving forward with a Venom sequel, once again starring Tom Hardy, directed by Andy Serkis, coming over from the MCU and going into the director's chair. And I don't know, it hasn't come out yet whether or not Woody Harrelson will be involved, but they did set up Woody Harrelson as Carnage in the post-credit scene to the Venom movie. Now, the reason why this is important to the story is that it certainly was a clear attempt from Sony to move forward with setting up their own Spider-Man miniverse adjacent to the MCU. But one of the things that I thought was smart about the Venom movie is that it's not connected to the MCU at all, but it doesn't do anything to contradict being retconned into the MCU down the road. You know, there's never a moment that's like, oh, the symbiote is the first alien anyone's ever seen, you know, or what is this Venom superhero? No one's ever seen a superhero. Like, it doesn't, there's nothing in it that would contradict it being part of the MCU, but there's no.
Was there any mention of the Spider-Man universe at all?
There's not. And it's interesting that they, you know, in the comics, the Venom origin story and character is so intrinsically tied to Spider-Man. And they completely removed Spider-Man from the Venom movie, even to the point where there's no longer a spider on Venom's chest.
Yeah.
So here's where we're at now. The deal that Marvel had with Sony was Marvel gets 5% of every dollar from the box office gross. Marvel already had the merchandise rights to Spider-Man, and they get to put Spider-Man in their other movies to their heart's content. And they come in as producers and have this creative oversight of the Sony Spider-Man films. After the massive success of Spider-Man Far From Home, and of course even Spider-Man Homecoming before that, Marvel went to Disney at some point in the recent past and said, hey, we want to go in on this 50-50 going forward. We'll put up half the money. We'll take half the risk. But we want half of your Spider-Man movies. We don't want just this kind of pittance anymore. And this is one of those things where you can kind of see both sides, because Marvel can convincingly and persuasively argue, you guys had, you know, run Spider-Man into the ground and the brand was in the toilet. We resurrected it to our mutual success. It's now your biggest movie. Meanwhile, over here, we've been making the biggest movies ever. And you could argue that, you know, giving up half of $1 billion is a lot better than keeping all of 100 million or what, you know what I mean? It's like you could make that argument pretty convincingly. On the flip side, from the Sony perspective, they're going, okay, we had Marvel's help in rehabilitating this character. It's now doing spectacular, no pun intended. Venom did well without their involvement. We did a totally separate Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse animated film. It was a huge success, critically and commercially, and was nominated for awards and all this other shit. We got this. We don't need to give you half of the Spider-Man movies, and if you're going to be dicks about it, we're just going to do it all by ourselves again. And thanks for setting us on the right course. We'll take it from here. Now, of course, all of us fans are terrified because we've seen what's happened with a lot of these franchises in the hands of anyone but Kevin Feige and the Marvel brass, you know, now Disney brass. And, you know, and part of Sony's statement was saying, like, you know, clearly Kevin Feige's too busy overseeing a gazillion franchises over Marvel, and why would he make time for one that he's that they don't even own? And their position was also that, you know, Marvel demanded half, or they'd take their ball and go home. We were willing to give them more than we had been giving them, but not as much as they asked for. You know, we wanted to keep negotiating. They didn't, and here's where we are. What this means for fans, though, you know, all because who cares about all this inside baseball shit as a fan, right? It's funny because I hadn't thought about this until I heard myself saying it just now about how much the Tony Stark, Peter Parker relationship informed a lot of the story beats of Infinity War and Endgame. But the MCU can cruise along without Spider-Man just fine. I mean, they proved it before they had Spider-Man. And in terms of their overall story, they could just go forward and just never mention Spider-Man. And it might be a little awkward, but it's not going to really do them any harm. On the flip side, for that Spider-Man franchise with Tom Hardy in the role, you know, to make a third movie or to put Tom Hardy in Venom 2 or whatever they do, and not acknowledge the MCU after the MCU was such a huge part of that first Spider-Man movie, and then after the second Spider-Man movie was basically Endgame 1.2, you know, this Endgame epilogue. Like, I don't see how they do that. My suggestion, if I was at Sony and they were adamant about disconnecting from the MCU, would be now's when you reboot again, and that sounds terrible, but hear me out. Now is when you do Miles Morales. After the success, or Spider-Gwen, or, you know, after the success of Spider-Verse and getting the mass populace more familiar with these newer iterations of Spider-Man, these more modern iterations of Spider-Man, you know, maybe now's the time you do that. Interestingly enough, as you and I were discussing before we started taping this episode, the MCU has established, you know, some groundwork to put Miles Morales there. Not every casual fan may have recognized this, but Donald Glover's character in Spider-Man Homecoming, who has a brief scene with Spider-Man, was the Prowler, Aaron Jarvis, from the Miles Morales stories. And he mentions even to Peter Parker, you know, I've got a nephew that lives in this neighborhood. So, you know, that little seed was planted, much like a lot of the seeds that Marvel Studios has planted, that, you know, a throwaway mention of Stephen Strange and the Winter Soldier, for example. You know, that stuff that's in there to set up this future stuff. So if I were Sony, and if this is really going to be the way it's going to be, I think the move is to, but it just, you know, it's a cash cow. It's so successful.
Yeah.
Is a studio smart enough to move on from Peter Parker for a while if that's what they're going to do? I don't see them doing that. I see them probably shoehorning Tom Holland into at least a cameo in the Venom sequel, and, you know, going back to the Sinister Six, and, you know, and by the way, the Mobius the Living Vampire movie is shooting as we speak with Jared Leto as Mobius. So, I mean, that's a thing either way.
Yeah.
You know, Venom 2 is a thing either way. I'm optimistic that the two players will get their shit together and work out another deal. It really seems to be to both of their benefit. You know, there is an argument to be made. I think the Sony side of it is, you guys own everything now. You know, Disney has Pixar, Lucasfilm, Marvel Studios. You just bought Fox, which means you got all of the X-Men and Fantastic Four characters back into the Marvel stable. Why do you need half of our Spider-Man film? Like, let us make a Spider-Man movie once in a while and just give you some. Why do we have to give you half? Could understand that argument, but... Yeah, it sucks for fans because we all love the Tom Holland Spider-Man. We love his inclusion in the MCU, and the Spider-Man standalone movies have inarguably been better for the association with Marvel. So,
you know, you can't assume that people won't let pride fuck with them, because they almost always do. But if at some point somebody's got to sit down and say, yeah, potentially we could make a lot more money with 95% of this revenue, but track record is that we won't, and the additional marketing power of Disney being tied in. Like, the situation is everybody who's on a hit TV show thinking that they're going to be a movie star on their own. It's everybody leaving the band because they think their creative vision would carry a solo career. And almost always it doesn't. They don't.
Who was the guy from NYPD Blue who left after like one season to be a movie star?
David Caruso,
and after a couple of high-profile failures, you know, many years later, resurfaced playing a cop on TV.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, like most, you know, for every Adam Sandler, there were like five SNL people who just sort of labored in obscurity after they left that show. So,
what, you don't think Tim Meadows is A-list? Come on, bro.
No, Tim Meadows isn't even the Iron Man of the SNL verse.
The SNL verse. Yes.
Yeah, just there should be an SNL verse, like a Coneheads, Happy Gilmore crossover. Like Wayne's World and the Church Lady.
You know who was thinking about a shared universe before anybody else and doesn't get enough credit for it, I suppose, now, and got this from Marvel Comics, is Kevin Smith. The View Askew Universe. He even had the same actors playing different characters in the same universe.
Yeah. I always appreciated that. Like, there was a universe that everything sort of existed in that was consistent, and there were always cross-references that I enjoyed.
Yeah, and to your point about marketing, I mean, yeah, with Disney Plus on the horizon, even without Tom Holland cameos, just the mere mention of the Sony version of Spider-Man in those shows.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, yeah, it's just, yeah, to think about, I hadn't really thought about it until you mentioned it, honestly, but to think about the sort of free marketing that comes with just his general inclusion in the MCU that you then get for your Spider-Man films. I mean, it's...
Yeah. Well, and the thing is, too, like, the average moviegoer isn't going to be aware of all this stuff. Like, this is a quote big close quote news story, which means that 99% of the population will have no fucking clue that it happened.
Yeah.
So people are going to walk into a movie expecting to see all the stuff that isn't there, and it'll be weird, and they won't understand why. Like, Sneaky Pete is a great show on Amazon. So Ricky Jay, he was on Deadwood, he was on a bunch of other shows, but he was a magician and a magic historian, like a truly fascinating weirdo. And he was a major player in the latest season of Sneaky Pete. He died toward the end of filming that season, and the end of the season is a total fucking wreck. Like, it just falls apart. It's the storyline's just dumb, and it doesn't feel like it gets resolved because a key character died and they couldn't do anything around it. Like, they had one short clip of audio, I think, and they shot somebody over his shoulder to make it seem like he was in the scene, but he wasn't because he was dead. Situations like that, unless you're like me and you love Ricky Jay and you put two and two together, like, oh, this is why it fell apart in the last episode or two, because they didn't have this key character to, like, resolve things with, you're going to walk away unsatisfied and probably annoyed because you don't know why it sucks now. Like, Spider-Man 2 is great. Why is Spider-Man 3 a shit show? You know? And that actually could be true for two consecutive or two different franchises.
Totally. Do you remember the Sopranos season? It might have been season two. It was pretty early when, you know,
with the CGI.
Livia Soprano, yeah.
Yeah.
That was wild. And that show certainly was a show that, despite that unexpected story turn, you know, was able to stay great. By the way,
they had enough going on, but, like, what if Tony Soprano, you know, what if he had died two-thirds of the way through shooting a season of The Sopranos?
Yeah.
Like, there's no salvaging that, you know?
No. Absolutely not. So, yeah, so that is a lot of inside baseball, but you know, the shortest version is that Marvel, when they were struggling financially and when comic book films were more of an unproven, seemingly less viable variable, sold off the rights to their movies to a bunch of different places, and these labyrinth, sometimes draconian, overly complex licensing deals that put all these different characters at different studios. And especially now that people are into the idea of shared universe and serialized storytelling on the big screen, which previously we had, you know, with Star Wars, and there's really few examples where it's like that's been such a thing like it is now. It seems like such a dumb move on the part of Sony to, whether it's pride, you know, Tom Rothman ran Fox where the X-Men films were. He's been credited with being very hands-off with auteur films like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, you know, he didn't meddle with. But, you know, word is he's the guy that said no Sentinels in the X-Men movies because he didn't want robots. You know, like, so, yeah.
Great call, bro.
Losing the X-Men and Fantastic Four and Daredevil, you know, maybe he's got a bone to pick. I don't know. I don't know the guy. He's the guy, by the way, the quote-unquote leaked test footage that resulted in a Deadpool movie getting made. He actually says, "Hi, Tom," to the camera at one point because that scene was made to show Tom Rothman to convince him to finance a Ryan Reynolds Deadpool movie.
That's hilarious.
Think about this. Think about in the coming years, you know, we don't have, for the first time in a long time, we don't have an Avengers movie on the slate. We have multiple MCU Disney Plus TV shows that will impact the films in a way that Agent Carter, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., you know, the network shows, and, you know, all of the Defenders-related MCU-adjacent Hell's Kitchen universe on Netflix never did. You know, those shows were impacted by the films, but it never went the other way. And the promise with these Disney Plus shows is that things that will happen to these characters will then be reflected on those shows will then be reflected the next time we see them in movies. One of the big rumors right now is that, you know, whatever happens in WandaVision, which promises to resurrect the Vision, of course, and really give a fuller exploration of Wanda coming into her own as the Scarlet Witch, that's going to lead into Doctor Strange, into the Multiverse of Madness, that Scarlet Witch is going to be a big character in that. What I'm getting at is there's not an Avengers movie on the schedule right now. There's a whole bunch of sequels to a whole bunch of franchises. There's Thor, Love and Thunder, Natalie Portman coming back as Jane Foster and wielding Thor's hammer, and, you know, Taika Waititi coming back, which is super exciting. Ragnarok being my third favorite MCU film. Black Panther 2, there's Shang-Chi, Master of Kung Fu.
To your point earlier about, like, B-list and C-list characters, they're leaning into, like, D, E, and F list now.
Yeah,
like,
they know
the fucking Eternals.
Yeah, they know we're on the hook. You know, if Guardians of the Galaxy work, then the Eternals can work. You know, like, it's brilliant. And of course, like any sports team or band or whatever, I mean, they're bound to stumble creatively and or commercially at some point. But the track record right now is just insane. I mean, it's just hit after hit. And, you know, talking to my 11-year-old daughter today about some of this, yeah, it's astonishing to her that Iron Man was ever a C-list character, because for her entire lifetime, almost, you know, he's, like, the biggest thing in Marvel. Like,
yeah. X-Men are, like, secondary or tertiary characters to Zeke.
Yeah, my kids are barely familiar with the X-Men, whereas, yeah, for you and I, you know, Wolverine, I mean,
that's everything.
And I connected way more to the X-Men stories as a kid than any other Marvel character.
Yeah, you
know? And now my favorite film characters are Captain America and Thor, and those were characters I knew about and read here and there but did not care about in the comics, except for on the occasions where, you know, the World War II story with Black Widow, Captain America, and Wolverine that was in an X-Men comic. Like, oh, this is pretty cool. What I'm getting at is, without an Avengers film and with all these other sequels to all these other franchises, with new franchises kicking off, and with the inclusion of the X-Men and all their related heroes and villains into the MCU, the Fantastic Four, whatever they're going to do with Deadpool, which, you know, the X-Men franchise had certainly wound down by the time Dark Phoenix was unceremoniously dumped on the public. And there's this New Mutants movie that's supposed to be kind of a horror film that's been postponed and postponed and postponed and may never come out, or may just be this weird VOD curiosity at some point. Who knows? But that's, you know, that had pretty much wound down. Deadpool, on the other hand, was going forward and was huge and was great and everyone loves it. Deadpool, I think, is in a unique position with all the fourth wall breaking that they could very easily just put him in the MCU tomorrow as is and yeah. have him make jokes about it, just like he made jokes about McAvoy and Stewart and the Winter Soldier and every other, you know, when he tells Cable, zip it, Thanos, like that was in the fucking movie, you know, like,
yeah.
So that shouldn't be a problem. But all the stuff I just said, and as excited as we all are to see Wolverine show up in the MCU, to get the Fantastic Four, all these possibilities, I'm super excited to see what happens with Doctor Strange 2. They can move forward just fine. It's a bummer, but they can move forward just fine without Spider-Man.
Yeah.
How does Spider-Man move on without the MCU? And you can almost feel the overconfidence emanating from the success of Into the Spider-Verse. And it's just like, guys, it's so short-sighted.
Yeah.
To think that, I mean, and who's to say that that movie would have succeeded the way it had if we weren't all in love with Tom Holland MCU Spider-Man when it came around, you know?
They are betting, it seems, on their ability to replicate the decade-long success of the MCU with their own Spider-Man galaxy without having ever shown the chops to do it.
Yes, exactly.
And that's a pretty for as risk averse as studios seem to be, that's a pretty ballsy position to take.
And that seems like hubris, right? That seems like yeah. arrogance. And I'm sure in their from their perspective, Disney coming in and saying, you know, we want half now to stay involved, probably seems like overconfidence and hubris in the other direction, because then they're like, well, we did Venom without you. We did Into the Spider-Verse without you. Those did fine. We can still do Tom Holland Spider-Man movies. Calm down there, Marvel.
Yeah.
You can't well, see both I think sides from it.
That's born of, you know, what we talked about earlier, which is the institutional disregard for what actually makes superhero movies work.
Yes.
And the lack of respect for the material. Like there's still a generation of leaders at other studios who think that we're dumb and think the material's dumb and they don't respect it and they do a shitty version of it, and then when it flops they see it as a reflection of, you know, that their own biases are correct, rather than realizing that they failed because they have a bad take on the whole enterprise.
Yes, and that's certainly what happened prior to Blade, prior to X-Men, you know, and I would say with the exception of X2, which certainly has a lot of great moments, and Logan, which is something totally other. The X-Men movies really don't hold up, but I appreciate the bridge that they provided between yeah. the super shitty comic book movies, attempts at comic book movies we had, and what we have now. Like, I don't think we would have gotten there without the X-Men to
well, and bridge I don't the think, gap. I don't think that I could stomach the jokiness of the MCU movies and the self-awareness of the MCU movies had they not played it straight with the X-Men.
That's a great point. I mean, that decision, which as I understand was fought for, to open the first X-Men movie with the Holocaust. I mean, understandably, there were a lot of people who don't get comic books at the studio going, we're not going to do a comic book movie that starts at Auschwitz? Like, what? You know, but those of us who knew the books and knew the material and understood all the allegories and everything that was going on in the X-Men all the way back to the 60s.
Yeah.
It made perfect sense.
If you're
going to
do
us.
A movie built around Magneto, you have to start it there.
Yeah. I mean, and it's just, you know, yeah, it was in retrospect a smart move, but at the time, yeah, it was super ballsy and people fought against it. There were forces that, and again, understandably, didn't think it made sense and thought if anything it was suicide. But that's a good point I hadn't thought of before, and I think you're absolutely right. And I would say I would put the Christopher Nolan Dark Knight trilogy in there as well.
Yeah.
You know, those, had we not gotten those, I mean, you know, the Tim Burton Batman even, I remember having so much significance for me back then because Batman was, to pop culture at large, Adam West. which I hated in reruns and resented as a kid because I was reading Frank Miller's Batman and was, you know, this is the real shit here. And I was, you know, going to Comic Carnival and being 10 years old and feeling like, you know, a hyper intellectual because I was reading this post-apocalyptic washed up Batman versus washed up Joker story, knowing that people thought of Batman as, you know, Saturday morning cartoon, Super Friends, or Adam West. Now, of course, as someone who loves mid-century culture and 60s television and appreciates camp and is a fucking grown-up, I love the Adam West Batman. I love the villains, I love the costumes, I love the sets, I love the corniness, the dialogue. It's all great, but I don't think I'd be able to appreciate that even now had we not gotten all these the multiple other great takes on Batman.
Yeah,
Yeah.
it's like you can handle getting your balls busted by somebody you know loves you, but
Right.
if a stranger steps to you, you're like, no, like you don't get to talk to me like that,
Excellent comparison. Totally.
because that's you know, like I as personhood in a lot of ways, and are taking care of that stuff, that goes a long way to me letting. Feeling comfortable letting them go in whatever directions, you know, we'll get into it later, but that's how the Avengers, I think, hit the genius stride that they hit, which is being respecting the material so much and loving it so much that they were able to accurately translate the whole spectrum of the comic book experience to the screen. The
Yeah.
seriousness, the poignancy, the melodrama, the campiness, the humor, the winks and nods, you know, the violence, like all that stuff in a mix, which you don't get unless you really live it and love it and immerse yourself in that culture. It's a specific, I mean, it's a unique medium. So being able to translate it from its native tongue into this very different medium, it's really hard. And like you said, like the whole reason we're undertaking this project is because it's fucking incredible that they not only did it once, but did it 20 times, 30 times, 10 years running, you know?
And the end of that phase, wrapping up with Endgame and Far From Home, and now potentially having yet another unexpected endpoint with, yes, I put emphasis on that word on purpose, with, you know, this news with Sony and Marvel, whether or not that gets worked out. That's also a great moment for us to take a look back and go through all of it and talk about what we love and what worked and what maybe didn't work and what was attempted and what almost happened and all that fun stuff leading us up to, you know, the next MCU film, which is going to be Black Widow, which my 11-year-old daughter told me today, without any guidance from me, like she just volunteered that she's super excited that they're making a Black Widow movie that's starring Black Widow, because she's only ever been in everybody else's other movies and she really likes the character. I was just like, fuck yeah.
And it's really interesting to watch the movies through our kids' eyes, because when I took my son to his first Indiana Fever game, his first WNBA game, there was a tall, muscular, tattooed black woman with a shaved head running down the court, and he was just like eating a hot dog, watching her run back and forth, and he said, "She looks like the Dora Milaje."
That's
And it
so
was like,
fucking
yeah, and I was like, the fact that he, the images of what strength is and what dignity is in his culture are so much different than what was presented to us.
Fuck.
And I've been trying to come up with words. It's like the benefits of the least important parts of representation. Like
Yeah.
when a little white boy starts looking at black women in a different way than any previous generation did, because he's simply been exposed to different representations of them. That's definitely not the most important part of it, but it's pretty fucking profound, you know? Like he's simply seeing the world in a different way, and he's not being, he's, I don't know. Yeah, maybe he's being trained, inculcated, whatever, but he's just being given different views of people to consider, and it's affected the way he thinks about them.
And it's amazing, well said as always. And it's amazing to remember when Black Panther premiered, all the imagery on social media of black people all around America showing up in like Wakanda-esque Afrocentric, you know, X-Clan, Boogie Down Productions outfits and stuff to just, like, you know, random neighborhood theaters and suburbs and inner cities and all around the country. And you know, people that were maybe casual Marvel fans or had seen a couple Marvel movies. I'm thinking of one friend of mine in particular who I don't think had seen any Marvel movies, but thought of the advent of Black Panther as a important cultural thing and wanted to go see it for that reason and ended up loving it. And, you know, who didn't see the introduction of the character in Civil War and didn't need to. I mean, that's just, yeah, we'll get there when we get to Black Panther, but there's just, so much fun stuff to talk about.
Yeah. I'm holding back, but there's a lot of stuff. A lot of conversations that I had with my son around that movie that he started because I wanted to let him guide the conversation, and I wanted to hear from him, like, what he thought about things or what, and it was the things he came up with were really interesting. The questions he asked were really interesting.
Oh, we'll definitely get there. And that reminds me of something with Endgame. We semi-recently watched some of the special features to Endgame and some interviews with some cast members. And a few of the actresses were talking about that one moment, that scene on the battlefield where all of these female heroes were assembled and going marching forward. Someone in one of the interviews we were watching made a comment about what a moment like that would be like for little girls, and, you know, not having moments like that. They were growing up, and my daughter kind of sat up on the couch and she was like, yeah, like me.
Yeah.
I'm like, you know, yeah, it's one of those things where you just kind of silently sit there nodding like, yes, I will not cry right now. I'll just be super psyched.
Well, yeah. And like my son and one of his friends had a sleepover last weekend, and I walked in on them arguing about who was going to play Ironheart in future movies. Like, they know who Ironheart is, and they assume that there's going to be Ironheart movies and Ironheart appearances in Marvel movies.
So rad.
Yeah, like, it's so... I feel sad for people who are mad about it.
Yeah, and one thing that I want to say as we sort of land the plane here that I thought about as you were saying that one of the many things the MCU has done so masterfully is given us that almost a totality of the comic book experience. And part of what was great about Into the Spider-Verse and being in the animated format and really giving us a comic book experience in a way that live action really can't is the Dark Knight trilogy. As great as it is, as deserved as it was of all the accolades, as endlessly rewatchable as I find particularly, you know, the first two movies in that. But I love all three of them. Even people who liked the film, one of the criticisms I often hear lobbed at it is that it's a detective noir action movie, a really great one, in comic book superhero drag. And I think that's a fair criticism. You know, it does suffer a little bit from that reluctance to embrace comic bookishness. It's also part of what makes this movie so great. I mean, you know, you could make an argument in either direction, but again, yeah, it does speak to the what's so magical and masterful about the MCU in that they were able to give us the full depth. And I appreciate and love the Dark Knight trilogy for really honing in and sharpening and perfecting one element of what's great about comic books.
Yeah.
But then Marvel has really, you know, just given us so many other sides. I wouldn't have thought that I would have cared about the Guardians of the Galaxy, you know, and I remember going to the press screening for that and being, you know, pleasantly surprised and relieved and stoked and also mainly happy that it worked so well and I had so much fun and there were so many laughs and whatever, but happy that it worked so well because I understood what the success of that movie would mean.
Would do. Yeah.
Yeah, for what else we can get.
I always think of the Dark Knight trilogy as Injustice for All.
Mm.
It's great, but it's oppressively heavy and bleak and great, but not fun.
Mm. Yeah, it really isn't fun. And those,
yeah, like Master of Puppets, Ride the Lightning, fun, stem to stern. And Justice for All, not fun.
Wow. Hey, man. I think that does it for our spidiness.